There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the bill we got? I mean, the bill we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my
So we're signing a very important document. A pretty comprehensive document. And we've had a really great term together, a great relationship.
A little bit from President Trump's comments yesterday or today, depends on how you look at it. Yesterday, our time, today in Singapore time. It's that whole international dateline thing that makes it a little more complex, but what is easy to understand, a momentous event for U.S. and North Korea relations. Not to take away the fact that there is a whole bunch of gray and nuance to this, but if anything happens, if any thaw of relationship between the U.S. and North Korea is to be gained from yesterday, I think it is a win. What level is that win? It may not be complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Maybe it is. Or maybe it's just a better communication channel between our country and the North Korean dictatorship. And it's not lost on me, the kind of guy we're talking about. With more perspective on that, our buddy from LifeSet.com, also the author of Wicked Mobile, Brendan Kirby, joins us now. Hey, Brendan.
Hey, Sean, how you doing?
Doing good. So, I mean, your initial reaction to the, whether it be the handshakes or what they came out and said afterwards, the big meeting.
Well, I had a lot of fun watching CNN and some of the other reactions today and last night, and I get whiplash, and I have a difficult time focusing on what path we're supposed to be headed down. Because if you remember when Trump was all about fire and fury and Little Rocket Man, people were running around saying he's going to get us into a war and he's being too mean to Kim Jong-un. And now he says that Kim Jong-un is very talented and his people love him. And these same people are saying he's being too nice to Kim Jong-un. So I guess we need to find this Goldilocks approach where he's just a little bit mean but not too much.
Well, okay. Listen, I think there's there's a pox to be on multiple houses there, and to pretend that we were just having a negotiation with some representative of Switzerland would be silly. Okay, we're talking about a despot, a dictator, a person that is not only deals with his enemies in a capital-like function or way, but he also starving out his people. Listen, we're not talking about a good person at all, so I'm not going to be one that paints this picture of Kim Jong-un as, you just got to get to know him, like a Dennis Rodman thing. At the same time, as an American, not a North Korean citizen, I got to ask, what's wrong with anything that at least moves the second hand back on the Armageddon clock a couple clicks?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you have to ask yourself what the alternative is. Because you make peace with your enemies, not your friends. So by definition, when you're trying to make peace with your enemies, you're dealing with people who aren't very good people. And so the people, a lot of the criticism of this is that, this elevates Kim Jong-un, and it gives him a PR victory and a photo op, and we shouldn't be doing that, and that's fine. But is the alternative, do we go down the Lindsey Graham path and go to war?
Yeah,
because it seems like those are really the two alternatives, or don't negotiate, don't do anything, and just keep the sanctions regime in place and hope that either changes North Korean behavior over time and that it doesn't lead to a nuclear exchange at some point. None of those options seem very good, but it seems to me that you're better if you're talking than if you're not, right?
Yeah, I got to think it is a lot harder to go to war with somebody that you've actually sat down with and have, you know, some kind of channel of communication. And also, I want to pose this question. I talked about it this morning. I'd like to get your take on it. If there was, I'll say this, if there was some glimmer of hope that at any point soon there would be a coup d'etat, there would be a change in North Korea, where the freedom fighters were just about to win and things were going to change for the people there, then I would say, hey, you know what? Better keep them in the icebox. Let that process work. Let freedom break out. But I haven't seen anything, even, you know, any kind of coup that would happen there, I don't think would be one that would bring freedom for the people. So he's going to be the dictator one way or another in the medium term, if not long term. So we got to figure out how we make this better for everybody else outside that country.
Right. I mean, he does seem pretty secure there. And as you point out, even if he were to go down, he almost certainly would be replaced by another anti-American dictator with authoritarian bent and nuclear weapons. So, yeah, we have to figure something out. Now, I am completely in the skepticism camp.
Yep.
And
yep.
This idea that, you know, a full denuclearization is right around the corner, I've always been skeptical about that. And when we get to the point, if we start offering really major concessions, you know, then I'll be right there with the critics. But so far, it doesn't really seem like meeting with Kim is that much of a concession. The other one today, people making a big deal, is that Trump said he was going to cancel the joint military exercises mm-hmm. with South Korea, which seems like a carrot he's dangling and something that can very easily and quickly be put back in place. I think Trump is trying to move North Korea with a carrot stick approach to making the deal. We've got the stick in place already, very oppressive sanctions that are having an impact. The reason North Korea is at the table in the first place is because they have a serious cash flow problem because the squeeze has really worked. So that is the stick. And the carrot is, I mean, it seems you have to offer something. You can't just walk in there and, you know, demand is unconditional surrender. That's not going to work. So, you know, so far, I mean, I'll just put it this way. Trump's critics are acting as if we have unfrozen billions of dollars worth of North Korean assets and have flown a plane with pallets filled with cash and foreign currency to Pyongyang. And it seems like we haven't done anything remotely like that.
No, it got rerouted to Tehran years ago. So if nothing's going to change there, so this whole idea of, you know, that we have been in this world's policemen, we have been the arbiters of freedom, and I got to tell you, as of late for our country, and I say as of late over decades, it's not looked so good, our efforts to bring democracy to places. So if any place is not looking for it right now, I think it's North Korea. So to take out the idealism, yeah, pragmatically, if you compliment this guy, people say, well, what you elevate him, you take the pictures with him, you compliment him, he takes that back to North Korea, and that makes him more powerful. I don't think that matters. I don't think whether he had the pictures with the American president or not, Quinn Hillier said this morning, it diminishes the office of the presidency. I don't know if that's not a worthwhile exchange for moving that second hand back on the Armageddon clock, somebody that has nuclear weapons. I mean, if we got to kiss butt.
Well, again, the standard has to be, what is the alternative? Because we just don't have good options. We have a sack of really bad options with North Korea. Trump inherited a really bad situation with that. And, you know, this, and I will say, this is not the way these things are usually done. And this is part of the reason why people in the know are freaking out, because it's so unusual. Typically, when countries try to do some sort of a diplomatic negotiation, you know, the underlings meet first for a long time, and they hammer out the details and the specific provisions of these agreements, and then the leaders get together and they shake hands and they sign the papers. You know, what Trump and Kim are doing is turning that upside down, and they're having the leaders meet first, and then they're going to hope that from that relationship flows an agreement and the details get filled in. Now, I don't know whether that approach will be successful, but I do know that trying it the other way wasn't successful. So, you know, if this is what it takes to get a chance for a peaceful settlement, I think it's worth trying.
Now, is it, and after the break, we'll talk about other allies out there, but is this going to be an issue for an ally like South Korea? Obviously, I feel they need us more than we need them, but there are promises made. during an armistice, you know, that we're there and we're standing by South Korea, is the idea of not participating in the joint military exercises. President talked about maybe pulling troops out. Is that going to lose us an ally? And I don't think we gain an ally in North Korea. Is it worth risking losing an ally in South Korea? And does that have some kind of shutter effect there to Japan as well?
Well, we're not going to gain North Korea as an ally. I don't think that is in the realm of possibility. And
right.
I don't think we're going to lose South Korea as an ally either. You know, it should be pointed out that in terms of domestic politics in South Korea, President Moon is, was a leftist candidate who campaigned on a platform of better relations with North Korea. So this is very much in the direction that he wants to go anyway. It's not like we're going to have better relations with North Korea and that's somehow pulling the rug out from under South Korea. This is the way Moon wants to go. The fear of Trump is that he says, we're just going to pull all of our troops out of Asia and Japan, South Korea, you're on your own, and America first. And I don't really see that being in the cards. But that, I think, is what people are referring to when they talk about those kinds of scenarios. The ultimate great solution out of this would be a formal peace treaty to formally end the Korean War, a North Korea that agrees not to have nuclear weapons in a way that can be verified, and normal relations that, you know, even if they're not friendly or warm, you know, we don't have thousands of artillery pointed down each other's throats. I mean, that is the ultimate game, and it would be, you know, if we could at some point get to the point where we could reduce our military presence in the Korean Peninsula safely in a way that wouldn't jeopardize U.S. security or the security of those countries, I think almost every American would agree with that.
What do you think about the theory, one of the many being floated out, that this is just a dog and pony show to give the North Koreans more time? Obviously, like you said, the cash flow crunch, but also give them more time. That, yeah, they destroyed this, air quotes here, that are lost on radio, air quotes, their testing facility over here, but really the good one is somewhere else, and they're still moving on with they're going to do this thing, act like they're scaling back the whole time. They're actually ramping up, and they're just buying more time.
Well, I think that is the strategy. I think North Korea is trying to buy more time, and that's why I think it's important that we keep the sanctions up, and to the extent possible, we lean on China to get China to be as cooperative as possible, because they sort of oscillate back and forth on that. But if you say, well, this is just a stall tactic and we can't tolerate that, then the logical jump from that is, you know, we better be prepared to go to war now and take them out before, you know, so they don't have a bind. You know, because if we don't negotiate with them, that buys them time too. So if that is an unacceptable outcome, that, you know, they're buying time, that means, and we should contemplate the full meaning, that means that we should be preparing to go to war fast, and that would be devastating. I mean, I don't know if Americans realize what a devastating war, an all-out war on the Korean Peninsula would look like.
We're
very war-weary from these low-grade wars we've been fighting, but get ready for lots and lots of casualties that make the Iraq war look like a picnic.
All right. Okay. With that, let's do this. We'll run to the break, come back more with Brendan Kirby from LifeSet.com, author of Wicked Mobile, also YellowhammerNews.com. Check there and Twitter. Find him at Brendan K. Kirby. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
Right, 124 FM Talk 106.5. Midday Mobile on this Tuesday. Talking with my buddy Brendan Kirby from LifeSet.com, YellowhammerNews.com, also the author of Wicked Mobile. Available now online by searching the search term Wicked Mobile, right?
Yeah, hopefully that will come up first in the search term. That's the goal. So sometimes you get references to that play Wicked.
Yes.
And then you have to say, no, that's not it.
Again, this is not the mobile version of Wicked. It's Wicked Mobile.
Exactly.
All right. We're talking about the negotiation and what happened yesterday or today, depends on how you look at it, in Singapore, and winners and losers. Right now, it's not enough information for me to make a decision. I just feel like any situation where you have better communication between an enemy of ours and our country must be some improvement on where we were before. But I've seen several people talking out there, and Washington Post and others have had articles out that say the big winner was China in what was done yesterday. Do you agree with that, that it's the Chinese that won?
Well, I don't know if the Chinese won, but China has multiple interests in the region. They don't want a nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula. That would obviously be bad for them. But they want North Korea to be sort of the crazy uncle in the room that rattles its sabers credibly every once in a while to keep the United States and the West occupied. That is very much in their interest, and I think it's a mistake to think otherwise. And part of the problem with our whole approach to the Korean Peninsula for a long time is, U.S. officials that have blinders on about this and think that China is some sort of a strategic partner vis-a-vis Korea, and that is not the case. So, to the extent that, that North Korea wins, that helps China. So, again, but they sort of have to play it carefully because they don't want North Korea to go so far off the reservation that they risk a war. They don't want that either. But they certainly don't want a unified Korean Peninsula under the auspices of the South with Western democratic values. I mean, that very much is not in their interest.
All right, let's shift gears now to back to this side of the Pacific and the G7 wrap-up and comments from the president back to Trudeau in Canada. I mean, there's a long... I mean, Canadians, that's the allies' ally, right? The United States. What's going on?
Well, this is just classic Trump. Trump reacts very viscerally and personally to things. And, we saw this, dating back to the campaign. Trump would say these outrageous things when he was the target of some perceived slight, and it didn't matter how small the slight was or how small the person was that was making it. He fires back. He acts that way as president, too. Trudeau said something that he didn't like, and he whacked him back in way over the top terms. And it was probably the worst thing an American leader has ever said about a Canadian leader. That's all there is really to it. I think it's a personality thing, and there's some domestic politics at play in Canada as well. Justin Trudeau's popularity in Canada has waned somewhat, and I think it's good politics for him to stand up to Trump. But you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of that movie Love Actually, if you remember that film.
I did.
And there's a scene in the movie with Hugh Grant, who is the new, young, untested British prime minister, and they're talking about this big summit they're going to have with the U.S. president, who is Billy Bob Thornton, in an excellent cameo, by the way. And they said, what are we going to do? And some of his advisors said, we really got to stand up to the United States. And he says, no. They're our number one ally. We need good relations. So then they have the summit, and Billy Bob comes, and he makes an advance toward this house aide to the prime minister that Hugh Grant had a crush on, and he takes offense to that. And as a result, at their joint news conference, completely reverses course and stands up to the United States, and he immediately becomes popular in Britain because of it. And I think that's what's going on with Justin Trudeau. Absent, I don't think Trump, made an advance toward some girl he has his eye on. But standing up to Trump, who's not very popular across the world, is good politics for leaders in most countries.
Okay, let's get into some. Well, I'll tell you what, about running out of time, but I want to get into the discussion of tariffs, just so people know what's true and not true, because I looked through some of those dairy things, and it's like most things, it's not as cut and dry as it seems to be thrown around on Twitter. I mean, there are tariffs. There are some really draconian tariffs after a certain quota is met with their control economy in Canada. I mean, there's some things at work there that just want to make sure everybody knows, how those tariffs are levied. It's not 127% on the first quart of milk that comes in the country.
Right. Look, these things are very complicated, and they're the result of years of negotiations over NAFTA, and the the ideal Adam Smith economic relationship is that there are no tariffs on any products, and it's a completely free and open border. And classic economics theory says that when you do that, both sides get richer because the countries can specialize in what they do best. So, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense for the United States to try to grow a lot of avocados because in most places, California accepting, you know, we can't do it, or coffee. You know, we're gonna make all our own coffee domestically. No, you have a country with a better climate that can make the coffee, and then we sell them wheat, you know, that grows better here. And that's like the classic economic theory. But in the real world,
hey, Brendan, we got to run to the news break. We'll come right back. Pick this up here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 136, FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Continuing our conversation with Brendan Kirby from LifeSet, Yellowhammer News, author Wicked Mobile. And just I would wrap up quickly with this Canada story and then get into one that's pretty Alabama-centric, although it takes us to Washington. All right, Brendan, so the tariff thing, I mean, this is... I'd love Ross Perot to come back from the grave and break out the big whiteboard and write what the actual here. Now, Sean, listen, here's what the trade imbalance is. Here's the percentage of tariffs. I would love to see that in front of me so we could make accurate decisions on who's getting a fair deal.
Yeah. You know, look, this is Trump, you know, and this is not new, by the way. So people who are surprised about this haven't been paying attention, but Trump for his entire public life has viewed trade as a zero-sum game. If one side wins, it means the other side has to lose. And this is completely against classic liberal economic theory dating back to Adam Smith, where trade benefits both countries. But he sees if there's a big deficit, it means that that country is winning and we're losing. And it's way more complicated than that. Having a big trade deficit with a country doesn't mean that they're richer and you're poorer. And to that, I would just say, look at some of the countries that have a trade surplus with us, Mexico being one. We have a trade deficit with Mexico. Would you trade places with Mexico? Would you argue that that they are richer than we are because the trade imbalance? Any reasonable person would say no. But to be fair, and this is why Trump won the election, it's not true to say that trade helps everybody. Trade might help both countries in the aggregate, but there are definite winners and losers from trade. And, blue-collar workers and factory jobs, very clearly, in the United States and the other Western countries, have been losers in the era of globalism because that work can be done much more cheaply in other countries. And that's why a lot of plants are closed and why wages have flatlined among that group of workers. And to just completely dismiss their concerns and say, look at Adam Smith, I don't think that's a very strong argument. But that's what they're saying. And when you get into the details of, dairy tariffs between Canada and the United States, it's complicated and it's the result of a lot of negotiations. And I think Trump might raise a valid point that should be an issue that should be addressed in this NAFTA renegotiation. But, I think the reason he brought it up is because, it just comes down to a personality dispute with Trudeau. He didn't like what Trudeau said.
So there were two high school boys showing off. Yeah, they're just saying who could puff up most, That's what was going on, you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, Trump is very visceral and very personal, and we saw that on the campaign trail. It repulses a lot of people that he's like that. But he can make a strong argument that it differentiated himself from that big Republican field, and that's why he won, because a lot of people respond to that, because a lot of people identify with that, because that's how they engage in politics in a very personal and visceral way.
All right. I want to, speaking of visceral, bring it back home here to the state of Alabama. Something going on Twitter right now started an hour or two ago. Josh Moon. Now, Josh writes for the Alabama Political Reporter, and Bill Britt from there has been on the show with me a lot of times. And Bill is one to admit that he's got some very liberal people working for him and some people that aren't very liberal. Josh, there's no real hiding it. I don't know how he's continuing to be a journalist and not a editorialist in the state of Alabama, but he's come out and not in so many words, I won't cage it, he called Jeff Sessions a Nazi.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, he is a columnist. I believe his work for the Alabama Reporter is labeled as a columnist.
Oh, okay.
I mean, he is in the opinion game. And, you know, his argument is, you know, he didn't like the recent announcement from the Justice Department that we were going to constrain who qualifies for asylum in the United States. Under the law, you know, it's pretty clear. You've got to be the specific target of persecution in your home country based on, you know, race, ethnicity, you know, there's a whole long list. The Obama administration interpreted that to mean, well, you know, women who are victims of domestic violence, they're being targeted because of their gender, so we're going to count them too. I think that's a simple misreading of the law. You know, that being a victim of a domestic abuse is, it's a bad thing, obviously. We don't support domestic abuse, but I don't think that you're being persecuted, you know, by the political system in your country because of that. That just means that, you know, there's domestic violence victims all over. You know, Secessions is saying, well, we're not going to count that for asylum anymore because, frankly, I don't think the law allows it. And a lot of people on the left are going berserk. They think that we, you know, should take them in. Josh said, you know, that makes him a Nazi under the theory that, well, you know, if you directly kill people like Nazis did, it's not really much different than if you send people back to, as he says, their certain death. I don't know if deporting illegal immigrants who are victims of domestic violence means that it's their certain death. I think that's a little hyperbolic. But, you know, I certainly don't think it makes you a Nazi, and I think it cheapens the, you know, the memory of the actual Holocaust victims when you say something like that. And you also have to consider, if we want to be in the business of letting anyone come in who is the victim of domestic violence, that opens it up to a whole lot of people. There's a lot of domestic violence victims all over the world.
And what do you tell the people inside this
country? What are you going to do?
Yeah, what do you tell the people inside this country? I mean, if that is asylum, if we are asylum, so asylum is a place to escape from something, correct? You know, to paraphrase definition of asylum. So therefore, that would mean that we didn't have domestic violence and gang violence in the United States, right? If we were the asylum from that, then you would have to go to the place that doesn't have that to find asylum.
Well, I mean, and this is the problem with, you know, giving asylum status to people who live in unsafe neighborhoods or live in places with crummy economies where there's not a lot of job opportunities. You know, those people are suffering in a very real way, but asylum was supposed to be a narrow and specific thing to help people who are fleeing persecution by governments, you know, or by groups. I mean, if you think of Jews fleeing ISIS, you know, ISIS-controlled areas, that would qualify. Or for that matter, Shiite Muslims fleeing ISIS because they were the wrong brand of Islam, that would count. You know, someone lives in a gang-infested neighborhood, that doesn't really qualify under the law. And the other thing, too, is under international law, you're supposed to seek refuge in the first safe country you get to. And it's a little suspicious that these Central Americans are traipsing through Mexico and, for the most part, are not seeking asylum there but coming to the United States. It suggests that the real motivation is the same as the other illegal immigrants who just want to come here because it's a better life. And I find it curious, for all of the commentary I read on my Facebook feed all the time about how Trump is a Nazi and a dictator and a tyrant and, you know, Trump's America is an evil, terrible place, that people seem to still be voting with their feet. I don't see a mass exodus out of this country, and I still see foreigners in these countries in similar numbers trying to come here. And you almost wonder if maybe Jeff Sessions is doing them a favor to keep them out of Trump's terrible America.
I follow your lead. I just, you know, when you break it down, I think that's what needs to be done more is people say, well, you know, like Josh says, Sessions, he's a Nazi. And you did it on Twitter. Good for you. I think we should all do it, whatever side, because there's right-wing rhetoric that hits me the same way, is to make people say, wait. Let's diagram what you just said and prove it out and not just say it and run off. You know, that's what seems to happen.
Well, and I just think we could all stand to lower the temperature a little bit. And, you know, frankly, I felt this way during the Obama years. I had lots of vigorous disagreements with Obama on all sorts of different policies. But I don't think it's good for the country long term when you demonize your political opponents. It causes hatred and dissension. And in a really big and ever-growing diverse country like ours, that kind of national unity is hard enough anyway. And I just think, I don't think we need to add to it. I wish we'd keep it on a higher plane, and that might be just too much to ask for on Twitter.
It's true. So speaking of which, if somebody wants to try to bring a civil discussion over to
a civil or uncivil conversation with me, you can hit me up at Brendan Kingston.
All right, Brendan, as always, we appreciate your time. We'll check back soon.
All right, thanks a lot, as always.
All right, coming right back, more of Midday Mobile. Coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about the Summer Better Than Others giveaway. Gets cranked up in earnest tomorrow. Details on that. Also, watching weather radar right now, thunderstorms affecting both Mobile and Baldwin counties. More on the way, moving on in. And then the weekend could be affected by rain coming from our south. Now, what that thing is down off the Yucatan right now is just a early discussion, but Dr. Bill does say whatever it might become or not become, it could be a big rainmaker by the weekend. We'll get details coming up in just a second.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 152 FM Talk 106.5. One of those thunderstorms just found us, didn't it? Bouncing around in Mobile and Baldwin counties, bore that this afternoon, and Dr. Bill says pretty much stays like this for the next few days. Right in the mix pretty much every afternoon, and southern part of Mobile County, southern part of Baldwin County, getting that rain in the morning time as well. Dalton, I saw this. I didn't get a chance to tell you this morning, as we've been talking about Game of Thrones, that HBO show, and the year and a half, whatever, between seasons and last year, almost 2 years. Well, HBO made it official over the weekend now. Don't worry, after you wait your year and a half for the final season of Game of Thrones, then they got the prequel happening. The prequel is happening, and George R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.R.
been one to read the Game of Thrones. What's A Song of Fire and Ice? I think that's what the Game of Thrones books are called.
Right.
I was just one of the series watchers, not the book readers.
I did, and in that, I have not read those books either. While I've read all Tolkien stuff in a particular nerdy-like fashion, I have not done that with George R.R.R. Martin.
But I know all the big fans were waiting on George R.R.R. Martin to finish, I think, what, the fifth book that he was working on? I'm not sure if
that ever... Weren't they peeved at the people making the show for HBO?
Yeah, because the first few seasons were all based exclusively on his books, and then once the series reached the end of where Martin had written,
then they just came up with
stuff. The series writers just kind of took it on their own.
Right.
But you had to know that, and everybody's known that this would be the end of Game of Thrones for a little while, but I think you had to know that there would be spinoffs. They weren't just going to let that money train roll off.
But I didn't know
they
would get... I thought that it was a contentious relationship between George R.R.R. Martin and the people with HBO. But obviously, money has patched things up.
Yeah, like it does in so many other relationships.
They said he's going to help develop it. The official synopsis of the prequel for Game of Thrones, for y'all that are fans, says it's taking place thousands of years before the events of Game of Thrones. And the series chronicles the world's descent from the golden age of heroes into its darkest hour. So this would be thousands of years beforehand. Only one thing they say is for sure, from the horrifying secrets of Westeros history to the true origin of the White Walkers, the mysteries of the East, and to the Starks of legend, it's not the story we think we know. Oh, come on, that's the whole... That's the whole thing with Game of Thrones. Whatever you think you know and you think what happened, that's not what happens. But don't expect it to come out anytime soon. Oh, don't worry, HBO. I'm looking at this report from The Hollywood Reporter. We're fans of this show. We don't expect anything soon
with
this show.
They're casting the adult characters, but they're 6 months old right now, the people they're actually casting to shoot in this.
We'll need them to be ready to shoot by the time they're in their 20s. All right, get some toddlers in here. The HBO suits recently said that any spinoff wouldn't air until at least a year after the final season of Game of Thrones, which doesn't even start until next year.
Wow. That's a long time.
So we're letting you know now but will forget three times over before it actually starts. But yes, so they've inked some sort of deal. People are getting paid, and a prequel taking place thousands of years before the Game of Thrones time period that we're in now. So it's a way prequel.
Well, how many other spinoffs do you think will be announced between now and when they start filming this first prequel? They'll probably announce at least two or three more.
Really?
I think, okay, I mean, there's so many, because like you said, Tolkien, I mean, what's so famous or what's so great about his books is that he built an entire world, and it was so specific that you could go into, I mean, you could have written history books about the Tolkien books, and you could say the same about Game of Thrones. There's just these entire worlds that they can spin off.
But at some point...
Kind of like Star Wars.
Right. Well, okay, Star Wars has done it, but I'll have to tell you that, and I've not been consuming, although you said Solo was really good.
Yeah, and I'm not a huge Star Wars fan. I like to go to the movies, but I really enjoyed the newest one.
Maybe there's still new stories to be told. I don't know. I mean, does it get to a point with Game of Thrones that, as we say in the country, there's no blood left in the turnip? You know what I'm saying? That there's no more. Maybe there is. Maybe with such a robust, you know, world that's created, the characters are just secondary, and you don't have to have this character or that character. You could just, you know, bring in a new set of characters, put them in that world, and it's fine.
Yeah. There's this new show I've been watching, Westworld. It's on its second season now. It's also an HBO show, and I know you haven't had the time. Like I want to
see it. I do want to see Westworld.
Watch the show. But it's, yeah, there's been times in Game of Thrones and a lot of other massive TV shows that are out there that it's just confusing. Maybe it's above my my IQ, the shows that I'm watching. But Westworld, I had to find a timeline. That's how confusing this is, because it bounces back and forth in timelines. I had to find an explainer. I'm that guy. I went and found an explainer online to tell me exactly what I'm watching, because I guess I'm an empty brain when I'm sitting there watching Westworld, because I have no idea what's going on in the show.
Well, but the nice thing, you know, if you're basing things off of like a book, then people... unless you're very strange, you don't just walk up to a book and open it up and say, well, start at chapter 7 and see what happened, right? So if they're telling a story that way, not in episodic form, but in long form, people have read up to that point and know the backstory. By the way, Terry, well, I did not know that was coming out, but you're talking about spinoffs. Mm-hmm. Terry on the text line says Tyrion's dance party starts next month.
Oh, great.
So already some...
Is that kind of like Magic Mike? Is that what he's...
I don't know. I don't know exactly what will happen with Tyrion's dance party, but there is, Terry, with early information there I did not have from the Hollywood Reporter, that one of the spinoff shows is Tyrion's dance party.
That's going to be a blockbuster.
All right, so there you go. We got to wait. Like Dalton said, they are casting six-month-old children now to star in the prequel for Game of Thrones that will come out by the time I'll get my AARP magazine before I get to watch... Wow, before I get to watch the prequel to Game of Thrones. So, oh well. All right, I'll pick it up and do it again tomorrow?
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good idea to me.
All right, we'll do another day tomorrow. It'll be Wednesday, I think. Yeah, Wednesday. We'll be here for Mobile Mornings at 6. Paul Feinbaum Show on the way next. For Dalton Orwig, Sean Sullivan. Bye, y'all.